Hello and welcome to Trails Worth Hiking, the show that brings you some of the most interesting backpacking and trekking routes in the world. I'm your host, Jeremy Pendry. In the first part of the show, we bring you the story and history of a trail. Then we tell you what it's like to hike the trail and how you can do it. On this episode, we describe a trail that is a multi-day hike through an incredible diversity of terrain. There are colorful mountains, glaciers, volcanic black obsidian, Mordor-like hills, but also valleys covered in green moss. All of this on a massive, very volcanically active island in the North Atlantic, where in the summer the sun shines late into the evening. That's right, we're going to a land settled by Vikings. On this episode of Trails Worth Hiking, we travel the Laugavegur Trail in Iceland. Welcome to the show, everyone. Thanks to our sponsor, Outdoor Herbivore, for sponsoring the show. Outdoor Herbivore makes tasty backpacking meals. They are vegetarian or vegan backpacking meals, but as I always say, you don't need to be a vegetarian or a vegan to really enjoy these meals. They are delicious. They use quality ingredients. They come in convenient boil-in-a-bag packaging, and they're packaged fairly tightly so that they can fit in your bear can or in your stuff sack where you keep your food when you go backpacking. And they have lots of calories per serving for a hungry hiker. Outdoor Herbivore gives Trails Worth Hiking listeners a 10% discount on every order. Use the discount code TWH10P, Trails Worth Hiking 10%, for 10% off your order on delicious Outdoor Herbivore backpacking meals. If you like to go hiking in the fall when maybe fire danger is an issue, particularly here in California, you can try some of their different no-cook meals. They have some options where you can soak simply in cold water and the meals are delicious. If you are planning for some winter hikes, you can try some of their soups so that you'll stay warm on a snow camp or even just a late shoulder season hike where it might be very cold at night. So give Outdoor Herbivore a try at outdoorherbivore.com. They ship worldwide, so even if you're not a listener here in the United States, you can order Outdoor Herbivore backpacking meals. Outdoor Herbivore at outdoorherbivore.com. Use the discount code again, TWH10P, for 10% off your order at Outdoor Herbivore. Thanks again to Outdoor Herbivore for sponsoring the show. All right. Welcome to the show, everyone. Please follow us on Instagram at Trails Worth Hiking Podcast, where we post photos from the hikes covered on the episodes, including your photos when the show inspired you to hike a trail. And that brings us to our Walking the Walk segment, where we give a shout out to listeners who have hiked a trail after listening to an episode about it. First, I want to mention Scott Van Alstyn. Scott hiked two trails that we covered on the show. First, he and his wife hiked the West Highland Way, which we covered on episode 32. They hiked it in June 2023. They hiked the West Highland Way in 7 days, so a pretty steady pace there. This was the first long-distance hike they'd ever done, and they used a baggage transfer service, which my wife and I did when we hiked the West Highland Way as well. And Scott says that was a very attractive feature for his wife to hike this trail. They saw two different groups, and this is something I think I mentioned on the West Highland Way episode, but it is true that there are sort of two distinct groups hiking this trail. There are those who camp and those who stay in the guest houses, and it is a very different adventure, as Scott mentioned in his report to me, because those who camp have a lot more work to do, and they're more exposed to the elements, of course. And so it does seem like it's a different group of folks, often younger folks with less financial resources that are doing it by camping. But sometimes even young families are camping along the way. Scott says he and his wife hiked about 15 miles each day. And because they were only carrying day hiking gear, he said it felt like a series of long day hikes strung together rather than a backpacking trip. Scott said they had the typical Scottish weather throughout with some drizzle and some sun. But then on the last day from Kinloch Leven to Fort William, They got slammed with some driving rain, cold weather, and strong winds, which made it a difficult day. And like my wife and I, they were not able to see Ben Nevis, the highest peak in Scotland, because it was shrouded in clouds, which is often the case with Ben Nevis, I've heard. So congratulations to Scott and his wife for hiking the West Highland Way. It's quite an adventure, and I'm glad they were inspired by the show to do it. After hiking the West Highland Way, Scott, though, wasn't done for the summer, decided to go out and hike the Pemmy Loop in New Hampshire, which we covered on episode 23. He hiked that in late July 2023, and he did this one solo. And Scott says this was the hardest hike he's ever done. He did the clockwise option. The first night he stayed in a campsite, but the second night he stayed at the Galehead Hut. And I really like that Scott was able to do this, where he was able to mix and match between a backpacking adventure and a trekking adventure, because there is the option along the Pemmy Loop to stay in huts that are managed by the AMC, the Appalachian Mountain Club. And so Scott did a little of both. He camped one night and stayed in a hut the second night. He said the route along the portion of the trail that's on the Appalachian Trail along Franconia Ridge was beautiful above treeline hiking, but a very tough day. He said the terrain is pretty brutal with lots of ups and downs. He said that although the Galehead Hut was a bit expensive, it was absolutely worth the money, and he ate like a king. He arrived there for enchilada night, which sounds good. And there was a big thunderstorm that night, so being in the hut kept him out of the weather. On the last day, the third day of his trip, he summited five mountains and left the AT to finish the Pemmy Loop. Over the course of his three-day hike, Scott covered 33 miles and over 9,000 feet of elevation gain, which was extremely challenging, but he seems to have really enjoyed the challenge. So thanks to Scott Van Alstyn for providing those reports, and we have some pictures from Scott that I'll post on the Instagram account. I also got a report from Kate Garn and her husband. Kate and her husband hiked Half Dome and Clouds Rest in Yosemite National Park, which we covered in episode 18. Like Scott and his wife, who were doing their first big multi-day adventure when they hiked the West Highland Way, this was the first backpacking trip for Kate and her husband. They were coming from the Midwest, so it was a big adjustment for them to be hiking the ups and downs of Yosemite. They were not able to get a permit for the Sunset Trailhead, but they came in at Cathedral Lakes, which made their first day longer than it would have otherwise been. They ended up hiking 15.5 miles on their first day, which is a really tough first day of backpacking, first time ever carrying that kind of gear. But they found a great campsite and promptly went to sleep at 7 p.m., which I think is funny to hear, because that happens a lot when you're backpacking. You basically run out of things to do the minute it gets close to dark and you're tired and you've eaten dinner and you just go to bed early, which is not such a bad thing. You get to sort of go down with the sun and get up with the sun. The next morning they hiked up Half Dome, and although it was difficult and Kate says she hiked slowly, they did make it to the summit. And then after lunch, they went and did Clouds Rest. So they did both in the same day, which was different than the way my family did it. And that is also a very tough day to do both of those in the same day. When they got back to their tent at 7 p.m., a horse camper came into their sight and had a steaming bowl of spaghetti and meatballs and warm rolls and had prepared too much for themselves and shared with them. So one of those magic moments on the trail where fortune strikes, and after a really tough day of hiking, they had some extra food, it sounds like. The next day, they hiked out via the John Muir Trail. It's kind of a downhill hike, 11 miles to Yosemite Valley. And then they were able to use public transportation, the YARTS system, the Yosemite Area Rapid Transit, to get back to their car where they had parked up by Cathedral Lakes. So thanks again to Kate Garn for her report. And I'm excited that she did her first ever backpacking trip after hearing about this opportunity on our show. And now they are planning future trips, and they're talking about trips to Mont Blanc and Grand Canyon, both of which we've covered, and the Trans-Catalina Trail, which happens to be our next episode. So there you have it. some great Walking the Walk reports, and keep those coming. As I say, those are the emails I love to get that really make me want to continue to do this show and to continue to work hard at making it a quality show for all of you to listen to. So reach out to me at trailsworthhiking@gmail.com with your Walking the Walk reports. All right, on today's episode, our guest is Nadine Slavinsky. Nadine is a writer. She has her own website at nslavinsky.com, where she has several books that she's written posted that you can buy there. She has written books about different kinds of adventures, particularly sailing adventures, which you'll hear about from Nadine. But she also has a blog about more of her land-based adventures, and that's called The Travel Bug. And in 2022, she and her family, along with some old friends, hiked the Laugavegur Trail in Iceland. And I had a really great conversation with Nadine about her hike, and I'm excited to bring that to you. Iceland is certainly a really unique location. There really is no other place like it on Earth, as far as I can tell. I grew up really loving Norse mythology and Viking stories, and even to this day, I'm a sucker for any television series about Vikings. And my family and I actually went to Sweden in 2016 and spent several weeks there and got to see some of the stones with the old ruins on them and sort of immersed ourselves in that history for a bit, which was really fun. But I haven't been to Iceland, so it was really fun to talk to Nadine about her trip there. So let's jump into it and talk about Iceland. Iceland is a large island in the North Atlantic. It's really on the rift or the divide between North America and Europe, right there on the divide between the two tectonic plates. Basically, the island exists because of a volcanic hotspot on that rift between the continents. So it's not just happenstance that Iceland is there on that rift. It is there because of the rift. It is only 16 to 18 million years old, so the island is not that old geologically. Although the weather is at times pretty harsh and hard to predict, due to the Gulf Stream, it is actually warmer than its latitude just below the Arctic Circle would suggest. There's a lot of volcanic activity there, a lot of geothermal activity. There are geysers and frequent volcanic eruptions. In fact, the English word geyser comes from the name of a specific geyser in Iceland. So you can actually go visit Geyser, the original geyser, I guess. The middle of the island is a volcanic plateau with both lava fields and glaciers, as well as mountains. Culturally, Iceland is considered part of Europe because of how it was settled. But physically, it's actually closest to Greenland, which is technically an island that is part of North America, although it's closer to mainland Europe than to mainland North America. Iceland has only one indigenous land mammal, and that's the Arctic fox, which they believe came across an ice bridge during the last ice age to reach the island. The rest of the mammals on Iceland are farm animals that came from Europe with the people who came to Iceland. So let's talk about the human history of Iceland. According to their own ancient manuscripts, the first settlers came in 874 AD from Norway. Although even Icelandic history suggests that some monks from Scotland and Ireland may have arrived before then, and there has been some archaeological excavation of huts that appear to have predated Norse settlement. There's the story that many of us know that the name Iceland came from early settlers wanting to discourage additional settlers and therefore naming Iceland something that didn't sound appealing. But it seems more likely that early settlers arrived and saw icebergs in the bays and named it Iceland after that, though no one really knows for sure. Iceland was independent in the Middle Ages under the Icelandic Commonwealth. Later, though, it became part of Denmark, and later a combined Denmark-Norway alliance. And when that broke up, Iceland became a territory of Norway. And then lastly, it went back into sort of a partnership with Denmark for a period of time. But in 1944, Iceland became an independent nation. Today, it is the most sparsely populated country in Europe. And I'll put Europe in air quotes, realizing that it's pretty far from Europe and sort of in the middle, as I said, between Europe and North America. There are roughly about 380,000 people who live in Iceland. The Laugavegur Trail is a trail in southern Iceland. It's a hike from Landmannalaugar to Þórsmörk. Landmannalaugar, at the northern end of the trail, is known for its hot springs, and Þórsmörk at the southern end of the trail is known for having lots of great hiking trails in that region, and a lot of Icelanders go there for day hiking. The Laugavegur Trail is one of the most popular trails in Iceland. National Geographic listed it as one of the most beautiful trails in the world. Before we jump into the interview with Nadine, though, I thought it might be fun to recount one of Iceland's sagas. Now, the sagas are prose narratives of historical events, so supposedly true events, that took place in Iceland in the 9th, 10th, and 11th centuries. They talk about the struggle and conflict among society of the early settlers. They were originally written in Old Icelandic, which was a dialect of Old Norse. Though they were first written down in the 13th and 14th centuries, so the stories may have evolved quite a bit even before they were first written down. But let's talk about one of those sagas, and the one we're going to focus on is one that took place in southern Iceland. So it happens to have taken place in the same part of Iceland where the trail is. And this is Njál's saga, or the Brennu Njál saga. And Brennu Njál means burning Njál. So that's a little foreshadowing here. This is considered one of the longest sagas and is a long, twisting tale with lots of back and forth between essentially feuding families. The two main characters of the saga are Gunnar and Njál. Gunnar is a warrior and Njál is a lawyer, reflecting kind of the two sides of Iceland, its sort of Viking warrior roots, but also its strong culture around rules for civil society. Njál and Gunnar are friends and allies, but Gunnar makes some mistakes and he gets banished. And he's about to leave Iceland, as he's required to do under the law, but then refuses to leave, which means that anyone now can kill him without being punished. And eventually he is killed in a standoff at his home. Later, though, members of his family end up in a feud with Njál's son. And the sons end up, without Njál's knowledge, killing an important enemy of theirs that is connected to that family. Then vengeance eventually comes, and they are all burned in their home. But the way it happens is interesting. Njál orders his sons to stay in the home, in a way to punish them for what they've done, because remember, he didn't know about it, didn't approve of it. And so he essentially seals the doom of his own family. And he and his wife were given the opportunity to leave, but they choose to stay and die in the blaze as well. One son-in-law who escapes the blaze then hunts down the perpetrators to avenge the death of Njál and his family. Now that's a highly abbreviated version of a very long and involved story, and I've left out lots of characters, of course. But that's just to give you a flavor of the kind of story this is, and that some of the sagas are. The Hatfields and McCoys have nothing on the Icelandic sagas. There are lots of stories of vengeance and retribution and essentially working out how civil society is going to go, how conflicts are going to be dealt with. So with that background on Iceland and that taste of the Icelandic sagas from the region of the Laugavegur Trail, let's jump into my conversation with Nadine Slavinsky about the Laugavegur Trail. Nadine Slavinsky, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So you have a blog called The Travel Bug. Can you tell me about that a little bit?
Yes, that's something I started recently, just because I love travel and I love writing. So it's one way for me to combine that. And I guess, in a sense, to make meaning of my travel and to kind of go over it in my mind. And it's great to be helpful to other people who might be looking for an off-the-beaten-path kind of adventure that they might want to do.
What kind of adventures do you cover on the blog?
I have all different things from horsepacking in the Rocky Mountains to longer hikes, such as what we'll be talking about today, to things like cruising the Galapagos, like how to find the best cruise at a budget price in the Galapagos Islands, biking adventures, hiking, snowshoeing, all kinds of things, not on a grand scale. I typically do things a week-long type adventures or even weekends, but kind of manageable mini adventures that, yeah, keep the life back in life, I guess the living in life or something. Yeah.
And this is not the only writing you do. You've also written several books, and you have a website, nslavinsky.com, where you have some of your books available. Could you talk a little bit about your other writing and your background?
I have a varied background. I started out as an archaeologist because my main goal in high school was to have adventure, to grow up and live an adventurous life. Of course, as an adult, that looks different than, you know, you perceived it to be at 15. But my ticket to that, I thought, would be by being an archaeologist. So I started out studying archaeology, and I worked in archaeology for a few years. But then I found myself drawn to the profession that I swore I never would have, teaching, because my mom is a teacher and I witnessed her. And I moved into teaching, which I've been doing for 25 years since. Because I love travel and I grew up with my dad sailing a small boat and dreaming of wide horizons, I always wanted to take a longer sailing trip. So I did at some point convince my slightly more traditionally minded husband that it would be a good idea to pack everything up for 3 years and go sailing. During that time that we spent 3 years sailing the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, I had a lot of time. So I was able to put another dream into fruition by writing a novel, which is a sea adventure novel called The Silver Spider. And I also wrote a lot of sailing articles for cruising magazines, which I eventually then reworked into a guidebook of what's called Pacific Crossing Notes for people who want to cross the Pacific on their own sailboat.
So how did you get into hiking and trekking from a background primarily in sailing, it sounds like?
Basically, I did anything I could do that I could afford. So my earliest adventures was, I think, when I was 19, when I took off on my own, I biked around Europe because I couldn't afford a URL pass, and you can camp and you can bike and it's your own energy. You're never paying for a ticket. And I really like being in the outdoors and I like physical activity. So it didn't have to be sailing for me or not necessarily hiking, but in the beginning, it was kind of budgetary more than anything. Later, we were able to do something like sailing once. Like many reasonable young people, we saved money to buy a house someday, but then we did the unreasonable thing and took that money, went sailing instead. So it's in part, really, I just want to be outside doing things that put me in touch with nature and the place that I'm in. And that can be by the vehicle of any different means, whether it's on my own feet or bike or hiking or sailing or whatever.
And so let's fast forward now to more recently. How did you learn about the opportunity to do the Laugavegur Trail in Iceland?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story in the sense of it was during COVID, during the lockdowns. And I think like a lot of people, my husband and I were sitting down and Zoom calling with people we haven't caught up with in a long time. And I'm American, my husband's German, and we met living in an international dorm at Cornell University, where we have a lot of friends and a lot of other international couples. And we Zoom called during the lockdown with them. And everybody was saying, we can't travel and too bad. I'll put a disclaimer. Obviously, there are far worse things about COVID than simply not being able to travel. So sure. Luckily for us, it was an inconvenience. But I say that knowing that it was a terrible experience for many people. Luckily for us, it was not. So we were able at that point to start to dream. And we were all kind of saying, when we can travel again, where will we go? And one person in that group said, I really want to do this trail in Iceland called the Laugavegur Trail. And they had actually been to Iceland two or three times, and therefore learned about the trail and had their eye on it. And by the end of that call, I was pretty much convinced. And I'm kind of an organized mind. At one point, I actually thought of being a travel agent. So I kind of set the wheels in motion. And we got that group a year and a half later, almost 2 years later, to go together. So when I say group, we organized it ourselves. We didn't pay to join some kind of group. But there were 13 of us in the end. There were five families, wow. All alums of that particular dorm, and nine of us and four children. So it was really great. So that's how I found out about it. And that's how we did it. And it was great to be able to reconnect with friends and meet the children of our friends while having a kind of an interesting adventure.
Well, it sounds like you are a lot like me in that you are a planner of these kinds of adventures. So what did you do to go about planning this hike?
I guess the big thing that we knew was the accommodation, because obviously it's Iceland, extreme exposed kind of conditions. We knew that there were huts. It's quite easy to get information about the trail, and there's huts along the trail that you can stay. And if you want to do that, we'll get into the details later. Camping is also an option, but for our purposes, and I think for 95% of the population of the world's purposes, huts are the way to go. And that was the main thing to get work on early. But once we had that, and again, I guess we'll get into the details. Once we get into that, then other things have to fall into place. Like, how do we get there? How do we get to the start point? How do we get to the finish point? And how do we coordinate five different families flying from, we had people flying in from North America and people flying in from Europe to meet in Iceland. But it does, like many other things, it falls into place. Even though you kind of, your head at one point is just this one big puzzle and you wonder if you're ever going to get it done. It just falls into place in the end. And what remains afterwards is just the adventure, right? Not the frustrations or the patience.
Yeah, I always try to think about how everyone else on the trip with me must feel about it because they didn't do any of the planning. It must just seem like you show up and you have a great adventure and it's all easy.
And I should I'll just add quickly. It's not like I totally organized everything. We had five sets of people all looking into things, but it definitely, I guess I can say I was the driver, but it was great in that sense because somebody would find out this detail and somebody else would find out this and suggest that. So that was an advantage, I guess, also.
Was there a particular resource that was most helpful to you that, I mean, I know you have on your website, on your blog now, you do have a couple of posts about this with some links to the official places where you can reserve the huts. So that's helpful to people. But before you had your post, what did you look to that was most helpful as a resource?
Yes. At first I thought, well, there must be a book. Let's get a book. And indeed, there are a couple of books, but there's enough information online. But like anything else, it's all scattered. So the art is really pulling it together in one place. And I hope that's what my blog post accomplished, that, you know, you have everything in one place and you can go out from there to find more details. So I can't name one source, but there are many useful little details that we picked up, which I'll mention as we go on.
Okay, so why don't we talk about the logistics? And I'm going to state the obvious one first, which is this is a summer hike in the North Atlantic here. There's no way you're going to do this hike in any other season. Is that pretty much correct?
Exactly. The huts close outside of, I think they're only open June to September. And I don't know if it's possible, but I have this in the back of my mind, the impression that the trail is closed, quote unquote, like it's not encouraged that you do it. And honestly, unless you're a professional explorer of some kind, there's no reason for you want to do it. I mean, the summer temperatures in Iceland are, I'm used to Celsius. So the highest temperature we got was 14 degrees Celsius. So in the high
50s. That's probably in the high 50s. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was a high, and it was below freezing several times or at nights, definitely. And sometimes during the day, and that's in this height of summer. So yeah, Iceland.
So in addition to air quotes, summer weather in Iceland being potentially cold, what are the other elements that people going on a hike like this should be prepared for?
Yeah, you really have to be ready for anything in the sense of, like, if you picture yourself preparing for a winter hike, that's, I think, how you have to look at this. You have to definitely, you'll keep your fingers crossed and knock on wood and everything else you can do that you get good weather. And we were very lucky that 3 or 4 out of 5 days that we had were quite good weather. But in the worst case, it can be very extreme. It can even be life-threatening. I mean, there has been a death on the trail in the summer through an out of nowhere snowstorm that somebody got disoriented and they couldn't get to shelter, sadly. So you can't treat it lightly. And I think Europeans especially are maybe guilty of that, that you're used to, oh, there's a hut and I'll get to the hut and there'll be shelter. But this is not. It really is extreme, and the temperatures are such, and you can get, being in the far North Atlantic, Iceland is exposed to very changeable, extreme weather. So you can have extreme wind, like tents got torn down overnight with people, with or without people in them. They got blown away. Freezing temperatures, potential snowstorms, and extreme winds. Having said that, you won't get that all the time. And I think it'd be very unlikely to get that for the whole length of the trail. And if you're very lucky, and we felt, like I said, we felt very lucky, we really had, if not blue sky weather, then non-rain and not hurricane force winds for 3 days in a row. And it was just stunning. But you have to be prepared for it to be much worse.
And despite that we're talking about potentially severe weather conditions, even in the summer, and the potential to at least have to be very prepared for those kinds of conditions, you're not alone out there. And from what I saw, it seems like this is a pretty popular trail in the summer. And so there's quite a few other trekkers out there, right?
Exactly. And that's the strange contrast about the Lago Vega Trail. And we actually hesitated when I first found out about it. It's named as something like one of National Geographic's top 10 hikes of the world, which automatically means it's too well known and it draws too many people. That was my fear, and perhaps the wrong kind of people, in the sense of, you know, bucket list type people who are maybe overestimate themselves. So we researched it, and happily, when we went, we found that in fact our fears were not realized. There are quite a few people who do it. It's extremely well organized in terms of there are the huts in place, and the wardens are very professional. And on the one hand, you feel like you're completely remote. On the other hand, there's definitely that safety infrastructure, and you're never that far from the next hut. So it's really only, so I don't want to exaggerate like the dangers, just to recognize that in the worst case, it really can be extremely extreme and perhaps dangerous. But in the normal case, you're probably just looking at being miserable. but hopefully, like I said, that won't happen at all, and you'll get some absolutely stunning, great hiking. You know, you're nice and bundled up while you're doing it. And the reason you're wearing sunglasses is not because of the sun. It's the sunlight reflecting off the snow that you get at the higher elevations. But yes, so there are a lot of people. There's always people around, and the huts are there with a lot of expertise. The nice thing is that it's basically done north to south. Everybody's going in that direction because you're gradually losing elevation. And in fact, the huts only let you reserve in that sequence. I guess the campgrounds, you could do whatever you want. And people set out at all times of the morning, all times of the day. In the summer, you get 16 or even 19 hours of daylight, depending if you're July or August. You know, some people might get started at 5 in the morning, some people at 10 in the morning. So it really spreads out as you go. And we never had the sense that, you know, this is overcrowded, except the very last day. The next day at noon, pounding rain was forecast to set in. And the hut warden warned everybody of that and said, I really recommend that you hit the road at 6. So everybody in the whole hut and the whole campground hit the road at 6, and there were 100 people hiking at the same time. But that was not what we experienced on the rest of the trail.
So how far of a hike is this, and how many days on the trail?
There are four main days on the trail. It's a long day to get in, or it's kind of a trail, a 3-hour bus ride to get in, and we can talk about that. And a three or four hour bus ride out. But it's essentially 4 days that you're hiking from point to point on the trail. And it adds up to, oh my God, I don't even have it.
I've got it down as 55 kilometers. Does that sound right?
That sounds right. And they're very short days. So on the one hand, you've got days of 14, 15 kilometers, so not even 10 miles in most cases. So it sounds like, oh, this is a walk in the park. And some days it felt like that. There were one or two days with a lot of uphill, so it didn't feel like a walk in the park. but the nice thing is, if you do find it easy, then you can park your stuff at the hut or at the campground, if that's your choice, and do day trips out of there. Although we were very active and we like a challenge, we found that most of the time we were happy to just complete the day and snuggle up in the hut and kind of enjoy that reward. And of course, we were with friends and catching up after 20 years apart. So there was that aspect also. But I think there is, I would caution people against looking at the short distances and saying, oh, that's easy. We'll put 2 days together. You certainly can. And there were people doing that. There were some guided groups there that combined 2 days into one. But they were cracking the whip and really dragging their feet. And, you know, you're in Iceland. Enjoy the details while you're there, and not like, oh, another mile, must make another mile type of mentality, I would say.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. from, you mentioned that there were some hills, but that if you're going north to south, it's mostly downhill. I've got the total gain going that direction at about 5,500 feet. So I'm guessing that's about 1,700 meters or something like that. Is it pretty much, I mean, it doesn't seem like the up and down here is a real issue. There is up and down, but that's not the main concern here in hiking this trail.
Exactly. Like I have a kind of a finicky knee after too many years of other sports and activities. Mm-hmm. And I was a little worried about carrying a heavy pack. So that is actually one of the challenges for us, not doing a lot of backcountry packing. It was the heaviest pack that I think I will probably carry for the rest of my life in terms of you're carrying a sleeping bag and your food for the, all your food, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. There's no food along the way. And I think I mentioned the sleeping bag. So it's quite a big, heavy pack for me. So I asked myself, you know, how is this going to be? And it's not constant up and down rolling hills. There's a big hill on the first day, which certainly is a challenge that you're just constantly going uphill, but that was fine if you're fit. And then the other days had one or two points where you have to go up quite as, you know, a significant rise, but it's not mountain climbing and the rewards are just constant in terms of the view. Of course, I say this with warm memories of clear skies and great views. It would be mentally a great challenge, I think, if you had the whole day. It will get, you know, the mist closes up the view and you're just doing that kind of terrain without the reward of the views. You know, it will challenge you to play all your mental tricks to stay on the positive side of that. And that could well happen. But hopefully, a lot of the reports I read are people say, oh, we were so lucky we had good weather. So maybe the general consensus or the general trend is to kind of caution people because we know it can be pretty miserable. But maybe mm-hmm. the chances are better than 50-50 that actually you will get that fine weather that we all hope for. But again, you have to be prepared for the opposite. And the great thing about this, if in case I don't want to forget to say this at some point, is having the equipment. We bought some new jackets and things that, you know, to replace our older equipment. Having the equipment, but more importantly, the mindset after doing this trip, it totally opened up a new world of hiking to us. We typically were fair weather hikers and summer hikers. And since coming back from Iceland, we go out in every kind of weather. And we'll be the only ones on the trail and really enjoying it. We'll go out winter, you know, we'll go hiking on the snow with our, there's these things like claws that you can put on the bottom of your shoes, like not crampons, but just little non-skid kind of things. Mm-hmm. So it really has given us a new outlook or the confidence, I guess, or opened up the shutters of our minds, I guess you could say, to look at what we can do off, quote unquote, off season.
That's great. And it's really, it is fun to hike in shoulder season, as I like to call it, you know, in fall and spring and in an area where it's mostly summer hiking, because like you said, the main thing is there's nobody else out there. People are pretty much always going to be concentrated in those summer months. So that is a good mind shift to have. That said, even in the summer, if you were to be camping this trip instead of staying in the huts, just to be clear, you absolutely need four season gear, right? Your tent needs to be a bomber winter tent if you're going to do this camping.
Absolutely. And so out of our self-organized group of 13 people, there was one family of four, the two adults and their two teenage boys. And they had been to Iceland several times and they were gung-ho. You know, the huts are expensive. They're like, no, we're going to camp. And they have done a lot of car camping in Iceland. But they were pretty miserable by the second or third day. And if you're in the campground is next to the hut. The hut has limited facilities. They have like a kitchen for the people in the hut to use, but not for the campers. So if you're a camper, you're outside, you're in your tent, and these are short days, right? So short hiking days. So if you get in after your 6 hours on the trail, or however long you spent the trail, it's a hell of a long time to be spending in your tent, exposed to whatever conditions. And there was one night in particular where the winds were incredibly high and we slept, you know, we would wake up and listen to it howling outside, but it swept through the campground and tents were down and people ended up sleeping in other people's tents. And I know a lot of people, you know, I think of myself as a tough person and a hardy person, but if you haven't slept in snow and howling winds, like assume you will be sleeping in snow and howling winds. And if you're okay with that, great, go camp there. But if you cringe a little bit at that, then think about the huts. Obviously, it's a much more expensive option. The campgrounds are approximately $18, at least that was the exchange rate in August 2022, whereas the spot in the hut would be $78. So obviously, it's a order of magnitude or four times more
per person.
However, there's also that amount of weight more that you're carrying it because you have to carry your stove and you carry your sleeping mat, et cetera, et cetera.
And so, okay, let's talk about that a little. So there, the huts and the campsites are both reserved through, I'm not going to be able to say this. I'm going to try. Fertafalag Islands?
Yeah, and it's Islands. So the hiking group of Iceland, yeah. Let's put a disclaimer out there. I will attempt to say things correctly. I'm not sure I succeed. So I think it's Ferðafélag Íslands. So it's the Hikers Association of Iceland, and they reserve through them. You can reserve the huts. You don't have to reserve the campgrounds. In fact, I don't think you can, and you don't have to worry about that. There's always space. So they fill up early. There's a website that you can go on, and so. For me, I wrote to them a year and a half ahead of time saying, when can I reserve? And they said, you can reserve for next summer in the previous September. So on September 1st, I wrote to them and we got everything we wanted, especially we were 13 people, right? We really wanted to make sure we got our spots. When we did the hike in August 2022, there are people in the huts with us who had failed to get a reservation for the dates they wanted as early as January. In other words, by January, it starts to fill up. And by March, it was full. Like people couldn't get spots. That one person found a backup plan, which was he was still able to book the hut by buying a spot off the Volcano Huts. It's a private tour operator that will book the huts for their own groups. And if they don't sell the spots, they then resell those beds. Like 10 times the price that they originally, he paid it, like a huge amount more than we did.
Oh, wow.
Just to get the spot. So the short story is book as early as possible.
Okay. And then the benefits of the huts, besides being out of the weather, they have a kitchen available so that you don't need to bring a stove. Although, as you said, no food, you bring your own food. It's sort of bunk bed style accommodations and also hot showers.
Yes, mostly. So okay. Definitely bunk beds, bunk accommodations, and in most cases, like up to 12 or 15 people per room, which is great for us because we basically took up a room. They had, as you said, a kitchen with several stoves and several sinks. And the nice thing is they have like a cauldron of permanently boiling water that you could take that water, make what you want and add to it and just always have water going. Toilets in every case and in all huts but one, Hrvatsnuskar, one of them, the second hut, which we'll get to at some point, did not have showers of any kind. So you could do a sink wash up. The others all had showers that you could pay extra for. Like $5 extra, I think it was.
Okay.
But so there is not like a common living room or a common dining room. So to me, having lived in Europe for a long time and going to the huts in the Alps, I picture a fairly Spartan but comfortable hut with a shared room and meals on offer. This is the opposite of that. It's a house that you can sleep in and it has a kitchen.
Okay.
And also like garbage you have to take out with you.
Meaning you need to carry it all the way to the end of the trail.
Exactly. So whatever you pack, you have to pack carefully and pare down on the packaging and so on, so you're not packing up.
Sure. Okay. And then speaking of food, one thing I thought that was interesting is you mentioned that you can't import meat from North America, even as an ingredient in a backpacking meal.
Exactly. So I was doing some research and I got, there's a website from the customs, Icelandic customs agency. And I got it wasn't entirely clear after going all through the fine print. And I went to the point of emailing them and they emailed me back and they said, absolutely not. No meat products of any kind, not even into the dehydrated meal. And the irony is, I think it's Backpacker's Pantry is one name brand of those dehydrated meals you can buy. Mm-hmm. So you can buy them in America or you can buy them in Europe. If you came with that Backpacker's Country meal from Europe, it's legal. But the same exact meal coming from North America is not legal.
Okay.
However, they don't actually check. We have never found anybody who arrived in Iceland and whose baggage was checked and they had to surrender their food. I like to play by the rules. I don't want to have any nasty surprises or have the stress. So now you know the law and the reality. So I guess you can make your own choice.
Fair enough. What about navigation on this trail? What did you do for that?
Navigation, it was great in the sense of to me, hiking is kind of a meditative experience where I look around me and I enjoy the scenery. I don't mind pulling out a map and finding out I enjoy knowing where I am at a given time, but I hate wondering, oh God, are we here? Are we there? Is that the fork? Is this the fork? That is not the case here. It is because it's a volcanic landscape and not vegetation. And quite a few people hike it every year. I don't know the number of hikers, but it's reasonably high. It's an unmissable trail. It's a very light scar across the landscape. So the only way I can imagine that it's not crystal clear is in something like a blizzard.
Okay.
So for that reason, we did have GPS and we did have a map. We never used either because it is absolutely, you cannot miss it. So basically there's not navigation in that sense.
Okay.
Which for some, I guess some people will miss the challenge. And there certainly are long distance hikes in Iceland that you can do that won't have as many people on it, that you will need the map. But even talking to Icelandic people who are really outdoors people, they don't do those without a guide. And that puts you in a whole different ballpark of expenses.
Okay, that makes sense. A couple more things on gear. One is there are some river crossings, so you need to be prepared for that. Is that correct?
Yes, there's maybe 6 or 7 rivers that you cross. And of course, it's very hard to predict and hard to say. So my experience was none of them were, they got close to our knees, but never more than knee deep. They were so cold, like you get in and you start squeaking because they were ice cold. It's just glacial runoff. Never was the current so strong that, you know, I thought this might be not safe. So that was never the case. However, that could change within a week. So that's very hard to generalize. On the whole, however, you can do this hike feeling quite confident that the river crossings are not a huge challenge. It's kind of more of a fun adventure in between. And the wardens in each hut, so even if you're staying at a campground, you check in with the warden and you can get information and the forecast from the warden, and they will tell you it's dangerous or it's not dangerous, and you can count on them. So I think that's your best barometer for those.
Okay. And one more thing on gear that I noticed is that, like some trips in Europe, it seems like if you wanted to spend the money or if you had difficult issues like back problems or something, there actually is a possibility to pay for luggage transfer from hut to hut if you planned it in advance.
Yeah. So one of our friends has kind of a back problem. So she had to do a hell of a lot of work to find somebody to do that, but she did. So it is possible. It's not as at your fingertips as it is in some parts of the world with very well-established hikes. I'm thinking of Camino de Santiago de Compostela, for example, that I've heard it's quite easy to book that. It is possible. I've got a link on my blog post to South Coast Adventures, I think who she booked it with. Essentially, they had a tour group running for whom they were doing baggage transfer, and they threw hers in with that. It was very stressful for her because it seemed like, oh, you absolutely must have your bag here and drop it off. On the way in, on the first day, you come in by bus, and the bus stops at a gas station, and you drop off your bag at the gas station, and then you leave, and you hope your bag miraculously makes it to you 2 nights later, because there's one hut that they can't get to. And even though it was she was pretty stressed out, oh my God, it didn't look like a genuine thing. You're kind of wondering, are they really going to, you know, what's happening with my bag? It was like clockwork. The bag was always picked up and dropped off as she had hoped for. So they're very efficient and you can trust them. It just takes a lot of organizing.
Okay. And then in getting to the trailhead, I think you mentioned buses for getting there and getting back from the trailhead. And I assume that's from the capital, from Reykjavik. How does that work?
There's a tour company in Reykjavik that does a lot of bus, that will bus you anywhere you want for all the tourist destinations. So when I say bus, it looks like a regular bus, but it's four-wheel drive. So it's kind of jacked up high. And the interesting thing is, you know, how your luggage can go underneath. They go through rivers. These buses go through rivers, like deep rivers. So you want to waterproof your bag because the bags can, not always, but they can get soaked because they will be underwater. And it's quite amazing to see these drivers. The bus leaves Reykjavik and it goes maybe about 2 hours of the 3.5 hours it takes to get to the starting point. The first part is on a highway, but then you're on gravel and then you're like on nothing. and they have to cross, and the rivers are constantly shifting, right? So there might be a gravel road, but the river will wash out part of it, or the best part, you might cross over here, or cross over there. So these guys, it's just fascinating to watch them. They're really expert drivers. So I had a lot of faith in them, but it is kind of an off-road adventure, even though it's a bus with a lot of people. But having said that, totally easy to organize. They run 2 or 3 buses a day. They told me, I was worried about the bus filling up, so I organized ahead of time. They said, we will simply add another bus. However many people want to go, we will add another bus. The thing to keep in mind is the start and end point of the Laugar River Trail are popular hiking destinations for Icelandic people who just want a weekend break. So they'll just go there and spend 1 night or 2 nights and hike locally, not overnight hiking, not going on the Laugar River Trail. So they're actually extremely well connected. So it was funny to think of, well, there's this remote area. So actually, there'll be many, many buses coming into Lanna-Laagur. That's the starting point of the hike. But many of those people are just staying there. They're not continuing onto the trail. And the same goes for the end point.
Okay. That's helpful to know. Let's talk a little bit about what this area looks like. And I have to say, when you reached out about this trail and I took a look at some of the information, at first I thought, you know, I've heard of this trail and it seems like this trail that's just crawling with people and one of those trails where there's too many tourists and all of that. And I was a little concerned about whether it'd be that exciting of a trail. I'm always thinking about what I would want to do and whether I would want to do it or not. But then I looked at your photos and I thought, this is otherworldly. This is an amazing location. And I said, okay, I get it. Everybody's here because it's worth it. So talk a little bit about what this area is and how it looks and what you experience traveling through it.
Yeah. And I guess what you'll notice is in the pictures, in most of my pictures, there's no people except for maybe my family. And it's not that I turned the camera because, as I said, you really do spread out and you really feel like you're on your own most of the time. So it did not feel like a crowded trail to me at all. And there was a nice sense of camaraderie that, even though we took up a whole hut room by ourselves with our own little group, we did get to meet some other people and you see them on successive days and you get to talking. So there is kind of a nice element to it as well without it feeling crowded. So as for the landscape, it's very changeable. It's incredible. I think that's one reason it's considered such a great hike and it's gotten so popular. It's not one landscape. It's 3 or 4 landscapes, that types of landscape. So you come in where you begin. Once you get to a high point, you see on to the north, this incredible like river plains with all these rivers just braided together. It's just an enormous amount of water just constantly running. And then where you're setting off to is this kind of rust colored, yellow, rust, brown mountains with snowy patches all over. So if you picture like a brown and white patched cow, that's kind of landscape. It's just brown or rust and white and rust and white and rust. And because there's all these snowy patches, very few areas of complete ice fields or snow fields, but a lot of snowy, big snowy patches, a football field long kind of thing. You come up to the high point in the first day, that's what you experience, and you're in the snowy, windy, feeling like you're high altitude landscape. And eventually, after the first day, you start descending again. And the second day is kind of a combination. You're coming out of that high altitude and coming to a lake-like area. The third day, you're hiking through a moonscape. You're literally like you're on the moon. It's just ash under black under your feet, crunchy lava with small volcanic cones on to the left and to the right. So it's this moonscape, but then to the distance is a glacier and not a little glacier. Like, you know, I've seen glaciers in Europe and sadly they're melting and they weren't that big in the first place. So it's usually you think of a valley with a chunk of ice in it. This is a mountain of ice, like a big mountain, and the whole thing is ice. And it connects to the next one and the next one, and then when the sun shines off them. So you have this layered landscape. If, you know, at your level, you have this lava that feels like it should be hot, but then boom, you've got this grandiose glacial landscape. And I've never felt, I've been to a lot of places, and I've been, you know, to the Andes, to the Rockies, to the Alps, high up places. I don't think I've ever had a view that felt like it reached that far in that. I think the word grandiose just keeps coming up. Like I've never seen anything that wild and grandiose, really. So it really is stunning. And then the last day, you kind of follow rivers and you come out to one of the few forested areas that there is in Iceland. It's actually a national park or a nature reserve of some kind. So it's kind of like a fairy elf kind of little mini forest feeling. So it's very varied.
That's quite a lot packed into 4 days.
It's incredible. And I think that's why a lot of people go there. So there's always that trade-off, right? Why do so many people go there? Yep. It's worth it.
I know I started this question with a windup that was sort of about how I don't want to go to these really, really crowded trails, which is just not true. If you think of my own history, I've done a lot of those big crowded trails like the Tour de Mont Blanc or the West Highland Way or places like that, because they are fantastic. And part of the fun of those trails is also the people. And it's also, you know, when you get to those huts at the end of the day, exchanging stories with people you meet and those kinds of things. So I'm not knocking the concept of a busy trail. But I had heard about this trail repeatedly, so I thought a lot of people must be doing this trail. But it is good to hear that it still can feel remote and it can still feel, you can still feel that connection with the landscape. So that's great. Let's talk, you've mentioned generally how these 4 days go in sort of landscape wise, but let's talk a little bit more about the specifics for people who might need to reserve the huts. And so day one, I'm not going to even attempt to say these names, so I'll let you walk us through the 4 days and sort of where you start and where you end. And if you have recommendations even for a different hut, if you thought, you know, maybe you should have done a different itinerary or something like that, anything you want to say about, you know, the best way to plan these few days.
Perfect. Yes, that's what I'll do. So basically the starting point for the Lago Verde Trail is at Land Manalogo. And actually, I asked as I went along, I asked Icelandic people, what is the meaning of this place name? And that one is Land of the People's Pools. So there's actually hot springs there, which is nice. So the bus leaves Reykjavik at like 7 in the morning, and you're there by 11 in the morning. And it's not a long hiking day to the first hut. So if you're budget-minded or you're short on time, you could potentially just take off and start the first day of the hike immediately without spending a night at Land Manalagur, which is, as I mentioned, it's a busy place because a lot of people are using it just as their own little weekend retreat. Huge huts, a lot of people. We used it as a place to throw down our stuff and kind of get into the swing of things by doing one of the local hikes. And it was very beautiful. In hindsight, it wasn't very different than what we were going to see on the next day of, let's say, real hiking on the trail itself. But we liked doing it. So that's the first kind of big choice you have. Do you want to throw yourself right into the trail? And you certainly could, and you would save one night of accommodation fees.
But why rush it?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it is, okay, if you have a family of four and it's $80 per person, you might rush it, you know, in that sense. But I would far sooner do that than combine two seemingly short days into one. I would not recommend that at all.
Okay.
Whereas I think I wouldn't really counsel anybody one way or the other with this first day. You could take off the first day if that's you're so inclined, or you could easily spend a day enjoying yourself there. So then from Land Manalagur, you really set off and you have your first day of about 8 miles to the really hard to pronounce one, which is Hrafnuskar. Hrafnuskar. Apologies to the people of Iceland. I'm trying. But considering how it's spelled H-R-A-F-N-T, and so on. So that day is up, 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 up. It's the biggest elevation to gain, and you really are just going uphill all day. And the nice thing about that day is there's one dip where all of a sudden you're in a green valley with steaming vents all around you. And this is where you remember, you know, how active geologically Iceland is. I mean, you can't forget, but the steaming events will remind you very quickly. And it's actually nice because it was quite a windy day. And even though it was sunny, it was very exposed. And I felt like it was very difficult to stop. So actually, that's one of the challenges of the trail is you want to stop for a little break or to take some pictures, but you can get cold very quickly, especially in that first day where it's very exposed and very high up. So that there is this one point in that first day where you can take a nice break and kind of be out of the wind and in a really interesting, unique area. And then you continue climbing up, 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 up. And it really feels, you do have this feeling like you're at extremely high elevation, which you're not necessarily. It's just Iceland itself is at high latitude and it feels like sure. High elevation.
Yep, yep.
But you're climbing 1,500 plus feet that day. Again, having said that, it's kind of gravelly. It's pretty good footing. It's not like you're jumping from boulder to boulder or something like that. There is some of that on the following days.
Is the hut at the top of that incline?
Yeah, so you climb, 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 and then you look down and there's a short descent to where the hut is kind of in the lee of the mountain. So it's just a short distance down. And from there, there are several short and longer side hikes you could take. There was a 15-minute hike that we took to a side point for view, and there are longer hikes that you could do there as well. And they have a nice kind of a deck where you can sit, maybe, if the weather allows it, and just take in this, you know, this feeling of being on top of the world kind of thing.
All right, day two.
Yeah, so day two would be Hraftinuskar to Alftavatn. Alftavatn is another hut and campground on a big, beautiful lake. And I had visions of going in that big, beautiful lake. It did not happen. And that was this really spectacular day because you're leaving this high, snowy landscape to, after a few hours of hiking from the hut, we got to an overlook where you see the lake at much lower altitude. So you're mostly going downhill that day, which is a little hard on the knees. So I was very grateful for my hiking poles for that. And all the times we had our river crossings, the hiking poles are very helpful. And all members of our group, many people had never used them before. And they were all in agreement that they were a must for the trail. So you reach an overlook point. So you see Alftavatn and the lake below, but you see the glaciers, and not just a little sneak peek of a glacier, but just laid out, taking up the horizon. So it's quite spectacular. On the way down to Alftavatn, there was some more difficult footing where you're kind of taking big steps from one boulder to another, which is a little harder on the knees for me, but it was still fine. There was one river crossing at the bottom. It turned out to be a baby river crossing compared to the bigger, wider, more rushing river ones that we experienced later. But that was a day of about 8 miles and very enjoyable there. At Alftavatn, there is a great place for a side hike. We did a 45-minute side hike called Brathals. It's another peak, and there was nobody there except for one of the wardens on his off day. So I figured we chose the right location.
That's cool, yeah.
It just gets you up to a nice viewpoint. And that's the night. It's a very exposed kind of area, and that's the night that the campground was struck by almost hurricane force winds, and it was a big hullabaloo that evening for the people in the campground. Day three is Alftavatn to Emstur, and this is the volcanic moonscape. And that was very easy going. It was not quite a flat day, but almost a flat day. And as I said, with the volcanic cones popping up here or there, there's a couple of river crossings. And that's one point where you realize that there's other people on the trail because, you know, you always get to the river and you stop mm-hmm. and you look. And you look, you know, should we cross it here? Should we cross it there? Because now you're getting to slightly wider rivers that, you know, it's not, mm-hmm. it's 50 feet, 60 feet. It's not the Hudson. But you think twice before you want to cross it at the shortest point, obviously, and the not deepest point. And again, the poles are very good for that, for judging the depth, right? Because otherwise it's difficult. So you do get the sense of there's other people on the trail because you catch up to them, and then you might catch up to them, you might not, and they'll cross, and then you look for your spot and you cross. All those rivers you can drink straight out of the rivers, which is just such a joy. How many places in the world can you do that?
That's great.
Kind of did it just for the sake of it. But also it means you don't have to carry, like if you wanted to carry less water, and obviously water is heavy, you could very much do it. You could not do that on the first day. On the first day, there's no rivers, there's no water source along the day. But all the rest of the days, you could carry, yeah, quarter of a day's water and just fill up as you go, technically, if you wanted to.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was a third day to Emstur. At the about a mile or half a mile before Emstur, there's an unmarked kind of gravelly path. The whole landscape is gravel, but you can kind of recognize that it's been traveled more. There's a turn off to a gorge, to a canyon, actually, I should say. And that was just 10 minutes off the trail, but you would never guess that it was there. And it was breathtaking. It was like the Grand Canyon, kind of like with all the colors and all the layers and waterfalls falling into it at one end and just this twisting canyon.
How did you know to take that side trail?
So there is a free online resource called WAP or WAPP, which has a breakdown, just very short. It doesn't go into great detail. It has a little map of each day of the trail. I think it has an elevation profile of every day and a few notes. And I believe it was there that we found a note that you can see this canyon. And because, like I said, you would not know that it was there. You would not have guessed. There's another resource that a young woman in one of the huts that we met had. There's a book, an ebook called Photographing the Highlands of Iceland. And the author is Sven Brock, B-R-O-E-C-K-X. Photographing the Highlands of Iceland. I think he sells it privately. He's a professional photographer with stunning pictures. And he has this book with GPS coordinates and tells you how to hike to viewpoints to take incredible pictures. So whether you're a photographer or not, it actually is an incredible resource for finding nice side trails. And I think we got several tip-offs from her through that book. So he does charge $20 or $30 for it, but that would have been the only piece of information we would have paid for, because everything else we got was free in terms of all the information available on the internet. So that is a really interesting resource if you're a photographer and even if you're not. That brought us to Emstrur. That's the second to last hut. And from there, you're on the home stretch of about 10 miles to Thorsmark. I say it Thorsmark, T-H. There's a letter P with like an extra where the P crosses its own line a little bit more than it would in our alphabet. And it's a short letter P in the Icelandic alphabet. And from what I understand, that's a T-H. So it looks
it almost looks like a Greek theta. Yeah. It's like part of a Greek theta. It's close to that. So maybe derived somehow from that.
Maybe that's related. Exactly. And so you will see it written. Sometimes if people substitute T-H for this P letter. So as an English speaker, I would say Porsmark or Thor's mark, but they're interchangeable. At one point I thought, oh my God, there's two places. No, it's the same place. So that's your final destination that you're going to. And again, Thor's mark is one of those places where a lot of Icelanders come just for their own little weekend getaway. So again, you'll be coming back into a place where there are quite a few people, but it's remote. There's no roads. Again, it's those four-wheel drive buses, etc.
Can you stay there at the end or do you go back that same day?
Yeah, so that's an option either way. And I would recommend staying there so that you're not in a rush or under pressure to catch the bus. The nice thing to remember about short hiking days and long daylight hours is, given the unpredictable weather, that itself, that combination gives you some leeway. So you know there's going to be a downpour tomorrow morning. You can stay in the hut until noon, or not even start until 2 in the afternoon, and have daylight through your entire hike. And the buses leave, I believe it was like a 4 p.m. departure, the one that we had booked. There's several a day. But I didn't want to hike with that deadline looming over me. So we were happy to have then spent the night at our finish point. But you could, again, if you're budget conscious, you could do that. I'll throw in here, if the weather gets really extreme, as I understand it, the wardens will actually shut things down. So they'll say, do not leave the hut. Okay, it's not like they're going to lock you in, but you would be a fool not to do that. And the people at the next hut, don't go. And the people who have reservations to come to your hut for the next night are not coming in. So everybody just freezes in extreme weather. So that could happen. It didn't happen to us. I think it happens a couple times every summer that you cannot continue on the schedule that you thought you were going to. How they actually undo the mess that must ensue, I'm not sure. But their priority is to keep you safe. And I would respect it. And I very much appreciate that. So keep that in mind, that there's always a possibility. And for that reason, it's good, again, to have a night. I figured at that last point to spend the night before taking the bus. So if worst case to worst, and we didn't get there until the day that the bus departed, we actually had a little bit of flexibility.
Okay, that makes sense.
And that last day, that was the day which for us, downpour was predicted for noon onwards. So we got a very early start and we kind of, it was like just a through march with a lot of people hiking at the same time. It was still beautiful, like following twisting rivers. It was more up and down again. There were a couple, because my mind was more on the end. It was like, where did this hill come from? I don't remember this. You know, nobody told me about this hill. There's a couple of longer uphills that doesn't break your back. But my mind was in a different place, so they snuck up on me. But it was an equally beautiful day. And then you come to Thorsmark. So at Thorsmark, there are actually three different huts, sets of huts. There's the one run by the same organization that runs all the other huts that we stayed in all along the way. And that's called Langidalur. If you book through Ferdefelag Islands, if you book through them, you will get the hut, their hut, which is Langidalur. But there's also another hut called Húsadalur, which is run by the private Volcano Huts organization. So if you are like us, I don't know how many people are like us, but one of our friends from university who has a partner from a different country, she's French, he's Icelandic, they live in Reykjavik, they came to meet us, and we said, oh, we'll meet in Thorsmark. They were at the wrong hut from our perspective. So do pay attention to which hut you book, even if you're not meeting up with somebody else, but that is significant for the bus pickup point, and it might be significant. There's a fork actually at the end of the trail, and you need to know, are you going that way? Are you going that way? So do pay attention to the exact name of the hut, not just the hut in Thorsmark, but which of the three huts have you actually booked?
From a planning perspective, as you look back on the trip, was there anything you would have done differently now that you've done the hike?
I was really glad with the way it worked out for us. I've turned over my mind, should we have just started out the first day directly from the bias? And not to rush it, but perhaps to leave a day for something else in Iceland. So one consideration I'll just throw in briefly is one good way to get to Iceland is Iceland Air. And Iceland Air has good, relatively inexpensive flight. Well, let's not say inexpensive. Not as pricey as some other carriers for going between North America and Europe. So, and they allow you to do an 8-day stopover and no extra cost, right? So if you're going to Sweden from the East Coast, you can stop in Iceland and no extra charge, but it can't be more than 8 days. But by the time you figure in a 4-day hike with a day in and a day out, and you want to go see a glacier, or you want to go see a waterfall, or you want to go see the place where the Rift Valley, basically where the continental plates are spreading, and you can see them, it starts to get tight for that. So I'll just throw that out there. And anybody who's interested, I just recommend you kind of lay out, if it's just Iceland, just quote unquote Iceland that you're doing, you have all the flexibility to use your time the way you want. But if you're using it as a stopover on your way to somewhere in Portugal or Sweden or England or Germany, wherever you might be going, you're going to have to actually kind of barter your days. You know, do I want to use it here? Mm-hmm. Or do I want to use it here? So that would be a consideration. So I personally wouldn't do anything differently, but you have to think about how you want to use your time.
As you look back on this and think about what you got out of this trip, why is this a trail you would recommend other people do?
I would recommend it because of the accessible remoteness. It's that feeling of a grand adventure, even though you're not in tremendous danger and you wouldn't be putting other people in danger in a potential rescue operation. You know, I worked at a national park one summer and we went out on some rescue missions and people don't think about the consequences. So it's in the back of my mind. You know, like if things do go, in the slim chance that things go wrong, there's a backup option, but I don't want to endanger other people in calling upon it. So it's an accessible, relatively safe adventure that you can do. And yet you have this feeling like you're the first person there or that you're at the end of the planet with scenery so unlike anything else. That fire and ice combination of Iceland is really unique. So those would be the main reasons I recommend it. It's a great physical challenge as well, but it certainly isn't just another tick on the bucket list. It's its own adventure in and of itself.
Is there a particular moment or memory that sticks out for you?
One would be the sunrise at that first highest hut at Hraskinuska. I just said it completely wrong again, but anyway, you know, slow pink sunrise. That was probably 3 a.m. And just, you know, to be there with your family and just appreciating that you can be there and experiencing that together. That would be one. I imagine every person will have their different high and probably low points along the way, but there are many. I guess the feeling of the ice cold water on your feet is another strong impression. Or the way the food never tastes better than it does at the end of a cold day on the trail, right? So, so many different impressions.
So thank you for telling me about the Lagavogur Trail. I do have a few other questions, though, if you have a few more minutes.
Absolutely.
Okay, so what is one piece of gear you don't leave home without?
In general, like now in my 50s.
Well, when you're going on a hiking trip.
Yeah, it's my hiking poles. And for a long time, I poo-pooed them. And I am a complete convert. I think you have a more healthy gait when you use them. You kind of swing your shoulders and it keeps my back loose and it gives me a little bit more stability. So that is one for sure.
I completely agree. I think of it as it's better to be a 4-legged animal than a 2-legged animal.
It's a great way to put it. Yeah.
All right. So what is one hike or a trip you've done besides this one that others shouldn't miss out on?
I love my recent discovery for me, the Via Francigena in Italy. It's a pilgrim trail in Italy. I guess you can compare it to the Camino de Santiago, but that gets something like 300,000 people a year. And I think the Via Francigena gets maybe 3,000 a year. I don't, we hiked it. We hiked parts of it. And I never saw it. We met six people per day. You know, and at the end of the day in the pilgrim hostel, there'll be six people. We did it in October, so I don't know what summer is like, but it's not backcountry. It's kind of more countryside and you're going through vineyards, but going through, you know, picture those scenes of Tuscany you've seen in the movies and you're hiking through that and you're going through villages with no tourists and we loved it. So the Via Francigena is really, I think it's the next thing that's going to get discovered and it will have people flocking to it in the next decade. So I'm glad to have done it now, or parts of it now, and hope to do more.
That's great to hear. And it's great to hear that you found a trail like that, that is that quality, that doesn't have the crowds yet. And I know I'm kind of a broken record on this point, but I'm going to, if you've heard earlier podcasts or earlier episodes of this podcast, I have often said that there are the name brand trails and they're name brand for a reason because they're really fun to do and people love them. And they often have, you know, like this one, just beautiful scenery, like the trail in Iceland. There's often a trail that is not too far away that has pretty much the same experience that nobody has heard about. And in almost any country, you can find that parallel trail that's near the sort of more famous one that is just for whatever reason, not taken off in the eye of the public, but is still absolutely worth it. And so it's great to hear about that kind of opportunity.
Yeah. And of course, the seasons help you make something that's very touristy into something that's less touristy by going into shoulder season or off season. So absolutely.
That's true too. Yeah. So what is the next trip on your list?
We have the next one planned for the summer in the Pyrenees. There is a circular hike called Carros de Foc, F-O-C, in the Spanish side of the Pyrenees. And I'm really looking forward to that.
How long of a hike is that roughly? So days-wise?
Yeah, I think it's 7 days is how most people break it up. And again, it's huts and you cannot camp. Like a lot of Europe, camping is actually not permitted. But it seems pretty remote for Europe and very spectacular scenery. So maybe we can talk again in the future. We'll see.
I was just about to say that. That sounds fantastic. I love that region and I've been to the Spanish side and the French side, but never have been able to do overnight hikes throughout the Pyrenees. So that sounds fantastic. I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah, I'll come back with some tips.
All right. And then lastly, last question. You have done lots of different kinds of adventure over your life, including cycling and sailing and hiking. Could you talk a little bit about how you think about those different types of adventure travel and how that fits in your life?
Yeah, I've often reflected on that. Like I mentioned earlier that in the beginning, it was kind of more bound by budget because the bike was just the cheapest thing to do. But I've thought about it a lot now that I've done many different things, and including horse packing is another great way. The horses carry all the weight, and you're packing steaks and you know all kinds of goodies. But I think in essence, it comes down all of it. I guess there's that slow travel and slow food, or now people use those terms. And to me, there's no best way to travel. There can be a best way to travel for a particular region, but any way that gets you out in a way that you're accomplishing it under your own power, because it gives you that sense of accomplishment. It gives you a sense of orientation. You got yourself there, so you have to know how to get there, as opposed to not knowing where, you know, yesterday we were in Paris and today we're in Budapest and where am I actually? You know, that kind of not knowing how the pieces of the puzzle connect. So I like the opposite of that. I like that feeling of I have conquered this small part of the earth's surface under my own power, not conquered in any other sense. But so it's just interesting. And it's nice to have the opportunities. And I guess I would urge people to look at it. You know, if you're a hiker, great. But there's other things that sometimes hiking is really, it's not the best way to do an area, or biking is fantastic, but not for a given area or not for a given person. So it's interesting just to look back and say, there is not one perfect means of travel, but there is a perfect combination in certain areas.
Well, that's cool that you see those. I was expecting you to give an answer about how different they are, but what I'm hearing is how alike they are, which is really cool, that they're just different ways of using your own body to be in connection with a space, yeah. which is great. And I think you hit the nail on the head about, at least the way I think about walking as well, which is that it's almost as if our brains, and probably they are, wired for that speed, and that we really take in a landscape in a more deep way when we're walking through it versus flying over it or driving through it. And I think on a bike, you know, you're going faster, but you're still feeling the elements. Right. And of course, you know, on the sea, also you're out exposed. So that's great to hear and good encouragement for others to try different types of adventure. Nadine Slavinsky, thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been very interesting talking to you, and I really look forward to hearing more of your episodes about other areas that I can go to in the future.
Thanks again to Nadine Slavinsky for coming on the show, and I hope that we've inspired you to hike the Laugavegur Trail. And if you enjoyed this episode, tell a friend about it, or better yet, give us a good review on whichever podcast service you use. And keep in mind that this podcast is entertainment and meant to spark your interest. If you decide to hike the trail, do your own research. Like anything else worth doing, outdoor adventure has risk. So when you go, pack your common sense. And when you get back, tell me how it went. Let's talk about our next episode. Next time on Trails Worth Hiking, we travel another island hike, but a very different island. Rather than being an otherworldly volcanic island near the Arctic Circle, this island is just off the coast of one of the United States' largest cities, yet it still feels remote in its own way. We'll travel for several days, starting from the island's town, hiking along the spine of the island, where we'll have beautiful views of the Pacific Ocean, camping in groves of trees, or descending to camp on beautiful beaches. And we'll have to stay alert, though, to avoid getting trampled by bison. Wait, beaches and bison? Yep. Next time on Trails Worth Hiking, we travel the Trans-Catalina Trail on Catalina Island off the coast of Los Angeles, California. If you have any questions or feedback on this episode, or ideas for future episodes, including if you want to be a guest and talk about a trail that you've hiked, reach out to me at trailsworthhiking@gmail.com. So start planning your next hike, and before you know it, you'll be on the trail. Thanks for listening.